A lot of people don't think Elvis Presley is dead and gone. If he's dead, he isn't gone because a lot of people still see him. It's one of the accounts that's mentioned in the new book, Haunted Rock and Roll by Matthew Swain. Matthew is a journalist, currently works as a research writer at Penn State. He's worked as a reporter and music reviewer for several newspapers and online outlets and is currently involved with a revitalized version of Omni magazine called Omni Reboot. And Matthew is as believes as I do that you can walk the fine line of journalism. You can be a skeptic, but still have an open mind. And he's written a fascinating, this book is a lot of fun, Haunted Rock and Roll. And we're going to find out what it is about rock stars that so many of them seem to stick around, because there are a lot of ghost stories about some of the biggest names in showbiz. And we're going to jump right into it right after this on Coast to Ghost AM. As I mentioned a moment ago, this new book, Haunted Rock and Roll, Ghostly Tales of Musical Legends, is a lot of fun. The author is Matthew Swain, and he joins us now, first-time guest. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
I had a lot of fun with the book. There's some great stories. We won't give away everything, but we'll give away a lot. And I wanted to mention this, the line that's in your bio about balancing skepticism with an open mind. You know, people have asked me this sort of a question, how hard it is to walk the fine line. It's not that fine of a line, is it? I mean, as long as you look at it as like another news story?
Well, yeah, exactly. What my approach has always been is to, go to your sources, try to double check those sources, let people, have respect for a person's experience, I think, whether they're in a car crash or whether they've seen a ghost, you want to respect what they've gone through and write as accurately as possible. So I don't really have a problem with it. I think the problem is the idea of skeptic has become connected with disbelief. So what I try to do in my book is to take myself out of it, my natural skepticism, and just let the sources and let the story kind of speak for itself. That's my kind of approach.
Yeah, skepticism doesn't have to mean debunking, but the word's been hijacked.
Right, it has been. I try to approach it. When I'm writing a story, and I've said this before, when I'm writing one of these stories and throughout the book, I can go from belief to disbelief and range in between. So what I try to do is allow both of those extremes in there. And, I think I don't want to make it sound like I try to make this a very academic. I try to have fun with it, try to make it interesting.
Yeah.
But, that happens.
Before we jump into the book, tell me about Omni. A friend of mine, Jeremy, had told me that Omni was rebooting. Is that up and running?
It is. I haven't been that active lately, frankly, but as a kid, I loved Omni magazine, and one of my favorite columns was the antimatter. So I pitched it to an early editor, and she accepted the idea, and I started to write just sort of in that fringe science, supernatural type of summaries, and I would try to do it every other week. But I haven't done it lately, though.
Yeah, I loved that column. I loved it. It was great UFO stuff way back when I first jumped into the topic. Let's get into the book. I guess rock and roll and ghosts, and it sort of goes hand in hand. I mean, a lot of folks, as you note in the book, would have said that rock and roll is Satan's music anyway, that there's something paranormal and evil in its roots.
Yeah, the interesting thing about rock and roll for me was that, they'll tell you, musicologists and experts in rock history will tell you that rock and roll isn't a unique American art form, but it is unique in that it best represents sort of the American ideal of the melting pot. So you have the blues and rhythm and blues from African Americans. You have folk, country, bluegrass from Europeans who come in. But what I'm finding is you can't separate the, spiritual, mystical sides of those cultures. Those types of spiritual traditions become embedded in the music, whether it's lyrically, rhythmically, whatever. So I think one of the reasons why rock and roll is so haunted is because it has, ideas of ghosts and ghost stories within it. And then the second reason I think rock and roll has this, has a lot of ghost stories, is just because of the sheer number of tragedies that has happened with rock musicians, like Buddy Holly. I guess you could say Elvis Presley lived a pretty tragic life. Even today with Amy Winehouse, Whitney Houston, Michael Jackson, and when you have tragedies, if you ask any ghost hunter, they'll tell you, you'll have ghost stories.
You make a distinction in the book early on about folklorists and ghost folklore and ghost lore. What do you mean?
Well, I try to make the difference between a ghost lore and ghost stories. Ghost lore is just folklore based on a ghost or spirit. And usually the distinction is very, very subtle, but ghost lore tends to be based, there's no actual person who said, I experienced this. It's sort of a grassroots culture that grows around these stories. I sort of found this when I was working on a book on university ghost stories. You know, maybe no one ever saw the ghost of the founder of a university. You can't find that person to tell you that firsthand account. But there are tons of ghost stories, and typically it's like, my friend knows a cousin who had a friend who saw this ghost. That is what I call folklore. I still think that's important and should be reported. But then there's also what I call ghost stories supernatural encounters. And these are people who have stepped forward either to the press or to, you know, writers and said, you know, I had this experience and here's what this experience is like.
You also make the point in the book about why it might make sense for rock stars in particular to stick around if these stories are to be believed. And I understand the caveat, because they die young, they die tragically, and they have big personalities. Would that make sense in ghost lore?
That would totally make sense. And also, remember, there's a connection, and I'm finding this out, there's a connection between the fans' desire to kind of have their idols remain. So sometimes you wonder whether, is this actually, you know, the ghost sticking around, or is this sort of a emanation of that desire for fans to keep hold of Elvis or to keep hold of Jim Morrison?
So wishful thinking that actually manifests itself.
Right, exactly. I mean, you could take this either as a psychological way, or perhaps, you know, to me it starts reminding me of Carl Jung and the imaginal, that maybe it actually can manifest in certain ways.
Let's jump into some examples. You start with a biggie, and I think a lot of people wouldn't think of Robert Johnson as a rock star. Make the case.
Okay. Robert Johnson is usually considered by a lot of music experts, and Robert Johnson, of course, is a famous blues guitarist, singer, songwriter, but he's usually considered the grandfather of rock and roll, and I would suggest that if Robert Johnson didn't exist, there probably wouldn't be a rock and roll. He's the right. Quintessential rock star, I think.
You know, the story about him and the devil at the crossroads. I mean, Eric Clapton, there's a Cream song that's been portrayed in movies. But tell the story for those who don't know about Robert Johnson. I had never read it in detail until this book, that he sort of sprung into being a star. He had tried and failed, and all of a sudden, bam, he got talent.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story, and it's pretty well documented. There's a couple different versions, but a lot of people like Son House, who was a blues musician at the time, knew Robert Johnson. And, you know, to set the story, you have the Mississippi Delta, which certainly doesn't have a lot of economic opportunities for a young black man at the time. But Robert Johnson would see these blues musicians who were making good monies playing the juke joints and always had a lot of pretty ladies hanging around. And he decided, you know, that's what I want to do. I want to become a blues guitar player. But the problem was, he was terrible at playing guitar. And he was also, according to Son House, pretty annoying. He was always, you know, trying to pick up licks and hints and whatnot from these circles of blues musicians. And basically the story is that either Robert Johnson, they told Robert Johnson to get lost, or Robert Johnson kind of exiled himself. And for a year, he literally disappears from the record. No one talks about him. No one sees him. No one knows, you know, where he's gone. A year later, he comes back, and he's not just as good as these, you know, master guitar players, but he's better. He's kind of created his own style that transcends, you know, the rootsy blues that were being played at that time. So there is a legend, you know, in the African-American community, especially in the Delta, of the idea that if you want something, you can go to the crossroads, and if you go there, you'll meet the devil, and he will proffer a contract, you'll sign away your soul, and you'll get whatever you want. So it didn't take long for people to start to speculate that Robert Johnson had done this deal, and that rumor spread through the blues community, and Robert Johnson certainly wasn't afraid of the story. He wrote a few songs mentioning kind of obliquely this deal with the devil, or that he's done something that a hellhound would be on his trail. So, you know, it ends, of course, tragically. He's either murdered or he dies through poisoning, they think. And they think that, you know, the rumor is now, or the legend is, that that was the devil coming to get his deal on the contract.
Didn't you wrote something to the effect that Johnson was drinking and admitted it at some point, that he'd been to the crossroads and made a deal for his soul, deal with the devil.
There is that legend that he would freely tell people that he did this deal. And the other thing is apparently he would practice in graveyards and cemeteries, which couldn't have helped his reputation, or maybe enhanced it, depending on what side you are on the fence.
So has he come back? I mean, you have some references in there that people have seen him. That are those good cases, or how would you quantify or qualify it?
I would consider that mainly ghost lore, because there are stories that when Robert Johnson met the devil, he's described as a very tall man dressed all in black. Now, there are, you know, I've found stories of people saying that they believe that that spirit is still around. Ghost hunters have gone down there and have claimed, especially at the legend has it that the crossroads is at the Dockery Plantation, I think it is. And ghost hunters have in their reports said that they have picked up EVPs and things like that. Nothing specific, though.
I got a little chill when I saw how old Robert Johnson was when he died.
Oh, no kidding. The interesting thing about Robert Johnson, he's kind of the granddaddy of haunted rock and roll, too, because he was one of the first, let's say, rock artists to die at the age of 27. His records aren't well kept. So some people speculate he was either 27 or 28, but most historians I find say that he died at 27. And of course, if you know anything about the propensity of rock stars to die at 27, you would realize that he's the founding member of the 27 Club.
I mean, we're going to touch on a lot of these, but I mean, give me the laundry list now, and we'll get into some detail later, but it's several of them.
Yeah, so there would start with Robert Johnson, Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, Brian Jones, Pigpen from the Grateful Dead, I believe, is there. Amy Winehouse, Kurt Cobain. That's there's a lot more than that, too.
Yeah, that's creepy. Let's talk about Elvis. I got to imagine, of rock stars who are presumably dead, that people have seen Elvis probably more than anybody. I don't know. I mean, some of them, they think they're seeing him at the diner. They're seeing him driving a truck. They think he's still alive. Others think they're seeing a specter. Give me the overview.
Okay. Yeah. There's Elvis ghost stories are very much like you said. It's almost like peeling an onion, because there's those who believe Elvis is still alive. There's those who believe Elvis is dead and he has a spirit. And of course, there's a couple thousand Elvis impersonators running around, and you never know whether people are seeing a ghost, or maybe they're just seeing someone dressed like Elvis. But having said that, Elvis is definitely the king of these rock and roll ghost stories. His ghost has been seen everywhere across the country, from Graceland to the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville to New Orleans, Las Vegas, and pretty much all points in between. So he has a pretty good career going as a rock ghost.
And what's your take on it, the general theory about where a ghost should be? I mean, in all likelihood, if there is such a thing as a ghost and an Elvis ghost, should he be at Graceland? Should he be in Las Vegas? Could he be in all those places at once? Well, what would the experts say should tie him to this mortal plane?
Well, that's one of the questions I had when I was doing this. And I reached out to my friend Elfie Music and Dan Colquist, who are both ghost hunters. Elfie was in Paranormal State, of course. But I asked them because I was confused. And the overall feeling is wherever they're attached, you know, psychically or psychologically, if they have a lot of attachment to a place, that's where you tend to see these ghost stories arise.
I seem to remember, did you have Priscilla seeing Elvis or seeing a specter of some sort at Graceland?
Actually, Priscilla didn't see her, but experienced a moment that she said was supernatural with Gladys, which is Elvis's mother. And Gladys lived in Graceland with Elvis, along with Elvis's dad and Elvis's grandmother, Minnie Mae Dodger. And Gladys died. It was really heartbreaking for Elvis. They were extremely close. And after Gladys died, Minnie Mae, or the Dodger, Elvis's grandma, said that she heard boxes shuffling and reshuffling in the attic, which seemed to be very much like Gladys, who was a little bit of a neatnik, would do. And so she claimed that Graceland was haunted by Elvis's mother. So years later, when Priscilla was living there, during a thunderstorm, she breaks the cardinal rule of horror movies and goes to the attic. And she said as she got up there, the light blinks on, and there's the clothes that Elvis's mother wore. And so Priscilla starts to try them on. And she said as she did, she felt a distinct kind of hug or touch, which, you know, she thought might have been the ghost of Gladys reaching out to her.
How credible or how good or how solid are the stories about Elvis in Las Vegas? He was a huge star here and basically lived at the top of the internet, what was then the International Hotel. Then it became the Hilton. Now it's the LVH. What kind of stories did you have about him here?
You know, to be honest with you, they're a little frivolous. So I kind of classify them more as ghost lore. But the one in the Las Vegas Hilton is that stagehands will see Elvis come down through the elevator. But, you know, with a couple hundred Elvis impersonators running around and just the Elvis culture that has grown up in Las Vegas, I think it'd be kind of hard to know whether that was actually or not.
Yeah, I would think the same thing would be true at Graceland, but you've got people, visitors, seeing what looks like Elvis or an Elvis impersonator on the grounds there as well, right?
Right. That story, it's kind of a famous story and picture that this was before Graceland became the big tourist attraction that it is with big group tours. Was just a small group who were touring the grounds. And the one guy looked across the pool to the pool house and saw what he thought was Elvis and took a picture. Now, throughout the years, this story has been, and this was after, of course, Elvis died, but through the years, people have wondered whether this, initially it was, see, Elvis is still alive, here is the picture.
Right.
But lately it's been, maybe it's the ghost of Elvis. And of course, the skeptical side of it is Elvis had a lot of friends who like to dress like him.
All right, we got to take a break. Matthew Swain, Haunted Rock and Roll is the book. And if anybody was going to come back from the grave, it might be Jim Morrison, who was into some pretty weird stuff. He is, as we will learn, a charter member of the 27 Club. That is a rock star who died at the age of 27. Some strange stuff from folks who have said they've seen Jim Morrison in one form or another, as well as Brian Jones, John Lennon. We got some stories about Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, Kurt Cobain, and a lot more to come with Matthew Swain, author of the new book, Haunted Rock and Roll. Stay right there. Much more to come on Coast to Coast. You know, the Rolling Stones, the world's greatest rock band, they were called, been around long enough now that they have multi-generations of fans. Younger fans may not remember the name of Brian Jones, but he was a founding member of the Rolling Stones. And as Matthew Swain makes the point in his book, he got kicked out of the band for bad behavior. And Matthew, as you said, man, you got to be pretty bad to be kicked out of the Rolling Stones for bad behavior.
If you're out partying Keith Richards, it says a lot maybe about your lifestyle.
So tell me the story about Brian Jones, also a member of the 27-year-old club, right?
Right. Brian Jones, you know, I don't think people realize over time just how important Brian Jones was. He was the founding member of the Rolling Stones. I mean, he basically put the band together. He was a multi-instrumentalist. I guess if the Rolling Stones needed someone to play sitar or whatever, they just gave it to Brian, and he figured it out in a few hours and could play pretty well. He was also, among other rock stars, had some pretty bad drug and alcohol problems, and he also had a problem of picking the wrong friends, as the story goes. And one of those stories about rock and roll and misfortune and tragedy that seems to erupt into these ghost stories is that Brian Jones, originally, the coroner suggested that Brian Jones died by drowning in a swimming pool at his estate. Later, probably not even more than 5 or 6 years ago, the story became more and more accepted that he might have been murdered by one of his caretakers, that person may have drowned him during a party. So a lot of ghost stories now. Marianne Faithfull, who was Mick Jagger's girlfriend at the time, claimed that after he died, she was looking in a mirror and Brian Jones appeared in the mirror, and then she slipped into a deep depression after Brian Jones's death, and actually, you might call it a near-death experience. She slipped into a coma and said she met the spirit of Brian Jones, who told her to go back and to live her life.
You tell a story in the book about Marianne Faithfull doing something while he was still alive that was kind of chilling.
Oh, yeah. The I think it's I King or I Ching is a Chinese fortune-telling system, and Mick Jagger and Marianne Faithfull were really interested in it and into it. And right after Brian Jones left the band or was kicked out of the band, whichever way you want to go on that, they were rolling. They were asking questions about Brian Jones, and on two occasions, the rune suggested that death by water, which was kind of a chilling forecast of how Brian Jones died.
Yeah, what you write is 2 weeks before he died, Marianne Faithfull tosses these coins and got a combination that meant death by water. And then Mick Jagger, a little disconcerted, asked her to toss him again, and she got the same result. That's kind of creepy.
Yeah, and I always wonder whether Marianne Faithfull and Mick were, maybe Marianne Faithfull felt guilty for not reaching out to Brian and passing on that information, but that's just speculation as I was writing it.
What do you make of, you know, the Stones, of course, they're kind of the bad boys in rock and roll. They were the anti-Beatles for a long time. They're satanic majesties. They had a couple of songs that sort of take a walk on the dark side and kind of flirt with the idea of Satan. Is that just appealing to teenage rebels as part of the rock and roll lifestyle, or were they really into this stuff?
They were, you know, from all accounts, deeply involved in the occult. Well, I don't know how deeply, but they were involved in the occult, and they certainly knew a lot about it. Kenneth Anger, whose name pops up throughout the book and throughout that era of rock and roll. He was kind of a hanger-on. He was also a movie producer. He was friends with Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones. He said that Brian Jones was involved in witchcraft and the occult.
And, of course, you also mentioned that, I don't know how solid the story is, that he felt that he got cursed or something during a trip to Africa?
Yeah, he did. He was very interested in international music and took a trip, I think to Morocco or North Africa, and he felt that a witch doctor put a curse on him down there. And the reason why escapes me, but he felt pretty sure that that something happened down there on a spiritual level that freaked him out.
Let's shift gears to John Lennon now. I don't know if you ever heard this, and I don't remember you mentioning it in the book, but George Norrie, one of my favorite interviews he ever did on this program, was a guy who said that John Lennon had made a deal with the devil. And it went on for hours about all the signs and parts of that. Was any indication in your research that John Lennon was interested in that kind of stuff?
Well, that's interesting. I do write a little bit about that later in the book, in the section I have on curses and premonitions. And in England and in Europe, the crossroads curse, there's a different variation of the crossroads curse. They have the curse happening on a bridge. And I kind of like the folklore behind it. So I'll tell you a little bit about that. You know, in the Dark Ages, a bridge could mean economic well-being for a small community, and bridges were very difficult to engineer and to build. So the story would go that this man would appear and said, I'll build you a bridge, but you'll give me the first soul to cross this bridge. And that story is kind of well-known in Europe. Now, the story that I found about John Lennon was one of those bridges where you can meet the devil was near his house. And Lennon went there in 1960 and met the man who's described just like Robert Johnson's devil, is this very tall man who wears, who's all in black. And John Lennon asked him, he wanted to be bigger than Elvis. And so the devil granted him 20 years of fame and fortune, but he would come back to take possession of his soul. So, yeah, I did actually come across that story, and believe it or not, that's the first verification that I heard that this is actually sort of a well-known. I got it from a folklorist and ghost story writer in Liverpool.
I'll have to look this up for you, Matthew, but I remember that show from a couple of years ago. It was a lot of fun. It was highly entertaining. Whether or not it's true or not, I don't know, but it sure was interesting. The guy made a pretty persuasive case. When you talk about John Lennon, you think of he's not the romantic guy. He's the hard nose. He's the skeptic. He's the caustic guy who would take you down a couple of pegs. But do you think he was, I know he had an interest in UFOs. I just don't know if he had an interest in spiritual type stuff.
You know, Lennon, I think I kind of found a kindred spirit in, because, as you say, he's skeptical, but on the other side, he had a spiritual side. You know, you have to remember Lennon was haunted by death. He was haunted by the death of his mother, who died when I think he was 13. His best friend and bass player, Stu Sutcliffe, died also very young. Brian Epstein, his manager, died while they were still famous. So he always had this desire to understand the afterlife. I don't know whether he necessarily believed in ghosts per se, but a lot of the stories that I write about are his attempt to communicate with his friends and his family. There's the story of Julian Lennon in, I think he was doing a movie project in Australia or New Zealand, and Aborigine shaman passed him a white feather. What the shaman didn't know is that years before, John had said, I'm going to try to reach out for you. If I die, I'll use this white feather. So that's the kind of ghost stories you find a lot around the John Lennon school.
Yeah, there's like a free as a bird with the Beatles. After John Lennon died, they got together to record a version of a song of his, Free as a Bird, right? Is there a feather story in that?
There is. There's kind of funny, and if you know John Lennon, he had a really weird sense of humor. The Beatles were in the Caribbean recording this anthology, and Free as a Bird was one of the songs they were working on. And as they were getting their pictures taken in a photo session outside in a courtyard, a peacock ends up walking in front of them and sort of flapping its tail. And immediately, according to the story, McCartney says, well, there's John, you know, trying to upstage us. The other story is that they, as they were recording the song, they were listening to the playback, and there was this eruption of static and electronic weirdness. And according to the story, they said that they heard the words John Lennon, you know, kind of embedded in that weird static, which they took as a good sign that he liked it.
If ever there was a building that was haunted or should be haunted, it's the Dakota, which is, you know, John Lennon was killed, of course, out on the sidewalk in front of the Dakota. Do you have credible reports of sightings of somebody like John Lennon at the Dakota after his death?
I have at least one semi, and again, it seems to be more ghost lore. It's the story of somebody who was a John Lennon fan was either in a storefront nearby or in an apartment nearby and was looking out the window and saw, you know, the iconic John Lennon with his I Love New York shirt standing in front of the Dakota surrounded by this haze or this aura. So that story gets repeated a lot, different variations, but I've never had one person, I couldn't find a first source for that. But the Dakota in itself is a pretty haunted building. I think Boris Karloff lived there. There's stories of, and I'm pretty sure they used it as a backdrop for Rosemary's Baby. There's stories about ghosts of children in it. So it's pretty haunted whether John's there or not, I'm not sure.
You have a couple of other stories about people who think they saw Lennon. Liverpool, any of those jump out at you?
Well, the one that jumps out at me is the story of right at the gates of Strawberry Fields, which is it used to be an orphanage, and it was the place that Lennon based his famous song Strawberry Fields on. The story is a guy was walking his dog. The dog becomes sort of agitated and stops. The guy looks up. He sees a young man and an older woman kind of staring into Strawberry Fields. The dog is so spooked that the man has to pick him up and literally walks him back home. He tells his wife at the time, who was very young, that he saw this, you know, what he thought was a ghost of a man and a woman. And she, who was not a Beatles fan, said, you know, I see them there quite often. And the speculation surrounding it is that it was John Lennon, the ghost of John Lennon, and his Aunt Mimi who raised him.
Let's jump to Led Zeppelin. And Jimmy Page, of course, is very much alive. He's not gone, but
right.
I didn't know that. You know some of the imagery that goes along with Led Zeppelin, and I just thought that maybe some of this dark side stuff was more an affectation, more to appeal to young rebellious music fans than anything else. But you make the point that he was really into it, is into it.
Yeah, I would have to say again, and I think you point out pretty well that a lot of these rock stars, you know, when we mention Brian Jones and Mick Jagger, they seem to flirt with this and maybe use it to tweak people to get them interested in the album or whatnot. But I would say Jimmy Page was very deeply involved in ceremonial magic and was a fan of Aleister Crowley. And he actually bought Aleister Crowley's mansion in Loch Ness, Scotland. So you're talking about someone who's pretty serious about it. And that mansion is incredibly haunted, which is, I have a couple stories from there in the book.
And Jimmy Page has told reporters, I mean, he's told journalists that he's got friends who've had some pretty weird things happen at his house, right? I mean, it's not something that we're just hearing third hand. He said it directly.
Right. This mansion is called Bulliskin, I believe it's pronounced. Aleister Crowley bought this house because he felt it was the darkest, most haunted house in the area. And it actually is, he said it was designed and laid out perfectly to cast spells in. So there are dozens of legends about this place. There's one that church was burned and the congregation died on the property. There's another story that a man was beheaded in the house. And so Jimmy Page tells the story of his friend who was sleeping overnight there. Jimmy Page was not around and heard this kind of rumbling, bouncing noise out in the hall. And he goes to the caretaker the next morning and said, I think the cats were out and they were bumbling about. Could you leave them in? And that's when the caretaker told him, you know, the place is haunted. And probably what you heard was the sound of this, you know, beheading, sort of like this residual beheading going on. So, you know, the interesting part for me was that during the interview, the reporter asked Jimmy Page, did you ever hear this beheading? And Jimmy Page said no. And then the reporter said, so you've had no spiritual interactions in this place? And he, and Jimmy Page said, I didn't say that. I just said I didn't hear the beheading, which gives you the idea that maybe he did experience something.
And of course, they Led Zeppelin messes around with some pretty dark stuff. There are some occult references in songs and on albums, as you note in the book.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's deeply embedded. Some people would say occult. I would also say that they were influenced by, you know, Celtic religions. Some of the symbolism in the songs are definitely pre-Christian era.
Jimmy Page, you said you weren't quite sure if he had sold that property. I know that we had Uri Geller, the world-famous psychic, who was on the show a couple of months ago, and we played a Led Zeppelin song, and he said, why'd you play that song? I said, well, I don't know, it just sort of fit. And he says, I'm looking out my window. My neighbor is Jimmy Page, living in the house next to him. That's an interesting name.
Oh, no kidding. That's awesome.
We're going to have to go to a break in about 2 minutes. Let's get started talking about Jim Morrison. I mean, if ever there's a guy who's going to come back from beyond the grave, you'd have to say it'd be him. He's into this stuff, right? You said from an early age he had an interest.
Yeah, Jim Morrison is probably the only rock star I know who believed he was haunted. The story there is that he was traveling across country with his family. His family moved a lot. He was a Navy brat. They were going through the Southwest. And they came across an accident involving some Native Americans who were lying outside of the crashed vehicle. And as they passed through, Jim told his friends later that he felt at least one or maybe more of these spirits enter into him. And, you know, you can see a lot of Native American and shamanism throughout his poetry and throughout his lyrics.
I guess, you know, you could say he dies at the age of 27 as well. Isn't that a weird coincidence? But the coincidence might be amazing there aren't more of them, because these rock stars, it sort of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, doesn't it? They become famous, they get rich, they have no restrictions, they live a life of indulgences that lead to bad stuff.
That's sure one theory. My theory is, like, with Jim Morrison and Amy Winehouse, sometimes the question I have is, how did they make it to 27? You know? So I have I still have a lot of questions of why 27, not necessarily that they die young, but the number 27 is just interesting.
Is there, is there some sort of more significance to that, numerology or something like that? Have you looked into it?
I did. And in the book, I take a very kind of flirtatious attempt at trying to explain it through numerology. And there are some schools of numerology who suggest that if you add the 2 and the 7, you get 9. And
right.
Some people think that's the artist or the mystic's number.
I'll tell you what, we'll talk about that chapter, if 27 turned out to be 9, after the break, and then we'll be opening up the phone lines. A lot more to come here. Haunted Rock and Roll is the book. It looks into haunted places as well as ghostly people. Stick around, much more to come.